Call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org. And to be sure your gift counts toward this fiscal year, please pay by credit card.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're going to start the program today talking about Ramadan. That is the Islamic holy month, and it has now begun around the world. This is the time of year when observant Muslims abstain from food and water during daylight hours. It is a time meant for self-reflection and atonement. But at this moment, many of the headlines about Muslims around the world are about conflict and war, from Iraq and Syria to Kenya and Nigeria. And that might cause many to wonder, how is that possible during this holy period? So we've called two of our regular contributors who often comment on matters of significance in the Muslim world. Asra Nomani is back with us. She is a journalist who's worked in Pakistan. She's author of the book Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Asra, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks.
Also joining us is Arsalan Iftikhar. He is the founder of themuslimguide.com. He's an adjunct professor at DePaul University and a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. He's joining us from Aspen Public Radio in Aspen, Colorado, where he's participating in the Aspen Ideas Festival. Arsalan, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. Anytime.
Asra, when you were reporting from the Middle East, did attitudes about change, about conflict, change during this holy period?
Well, there was this ordinary observance that happened. I was in Pakistan right after bombs had dropped in Afghanistan in 2001. And I was sitting in Karachi, and you could literally hear the fighter jets and the bombers go across the skies to Afghanistan. And what I noticed was that people would continue with their ordinary lives, but there would be this sadness also that was within their thinking and their conversations because there was war and conflict all around them.
Arsalan, you wrote last year that, quote, leaders around the world, religious or otherwise, must leverage Ramadan to find peaceful political situations for these internal violent quagmires plaguing the Muslim world. Have you any evidence of that ever happening? Do you have any sense that that does influence the thinking of the people who are direct participants in these conflicts?
Well, Michelle, it should, because the Prophet Muhammad, who is the Prophet of Islam, had categorically forbidden any sort of fighting during the month of Ramadan and other months during the year. And, you know, as I called for last year in a Time magazine website article, you know, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had also called for a ceasefire, particularly in Syria at the time, because of the demolition of Homs, to allow for humanitarian aid for relief organizations to get in so that refugees could have access to the corridors to Turkey. I mean, it's not a time, you know, you're not going to end a war in a 30-day period, but if you have a 30-day cooling off period in any armed conflict in the world, as an international human rights lawyer, you know, you can create temporary humanitarian corridors, you can get food and, you know, medical resources to people who actually need it. And, you know, I think it gives both sides on any side of a conflict the opportunity to think about really what's going on.
I wanted to ask you about this because I know neither of you is a Islamic scholar per se, but you've done a lot of study into the history, you know, of the faith as well. Is it your sense that the part of the purpose of Ramadan, in addition to kind of the spiritual purpose, is to provide that kind of cooling off period? But the question is, do we have any historical sense of whether that actually occurred?
You know, when I think about this month, I always think about how it is that the concept with which we're born in Islam, the idea is that the breath of God enters into you in your mother's womb, and it's nafs al-ruh is the concept. And what we're talking about right here is the jihad of bodies, right, of war, of people who are at conflict with each other. But really, the deeper purpose in Ramzan is to have a jihad bil nafs, a struggle of the soul. And that's what I think is this moment and this opportunity. Historically, there's always been this call for ceasefires, and there's this calming that happens within Muslim communities. And that's what I think we're in that moment of struggle. Right now, this, you know, new force through Iraq has asked all Muslims to claim allegiance to it. I, as a Muslim, would never claim allegiance to this new organization. And this is a struggle within our community for our soul and what direction we're going to go. And as Arsalan is saying, you know, we have to take this pause and really try to reflect on what we can do to bring healing to our communities.
Arsalan, what about that? Do you
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question, Michelle. There's a very famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad where he says that whoever does not give up evil actions during the month of Ramadan, then God is not in need of them to give up food or drink during the month of Ramadan. You know, Ramadan is not just a, you know, a fasting exercise where you're abstaining from food and water for 30 days from dawn until dusk. It is a spiritual cleansing exercise, and it is as much internal as it is external. And as the Prophet Muhammad said in the saying that, you know, anyone who doesn't give up evil actions during Ramadan, God is not in need of them giving up food and drink. And so I think that sort of hits at the duality of, you know, the practical aspects of Ramadan where people do, 1.7 billion people do fast, but it's also an important time for those 1.7 billion Muslims to also self-reflect within ourselves. You know, in 2013, we mentioned that Ban Ki-moon called for a ceasefire. 2 days ago now, the Arab League and the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, which is the largest umbrella organization of 57 Muslim-majority nations on earth, have called for a ceasefire this year in places like Syria and Iraq and in Nigeria as well. And so, you know, we hope that this spiritual aspect will also result in some sort of political realities that will make it easier for war-torn people on the ground.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about observing Ramadan in areas of conflict. My guests are Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com. He's a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. Also joining us, journalist Asra Nomani, who has been a regular contributor on a number of our programs and segments. So you know, Asra, you've been participating in training over the years, members of the U.S. military on issues of cultural sensitivity. What have you taught them about Ramadan?
Well, I've taught them, you know, definitely don't try to have important conversations with people in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. Try to wait till the sun has set and, you know, knock on doors or sit down and then try to have meaningful, you know, interviews or conversations. Irritability goes up, you know, all of these aspects that are just clinical of the body. But I also tell them that, you know, it's a moment when you can actually try to reach people in the soft of their heart, because as Arsalan is saying, you know, we all know that there is this higher calling during this month and that there is this effort to try to be the better person, you know, to try to be the better person within yourself. And though there are all of these political initiatives that are being done by some Muslim leaders, you know, I think even they have their own conflicts, and we don't know in some of them, you know, what is sincere and what isn't, and, you know, who's pulling what strings where. And ultimately, the challenge, both on the ordinary people and the leadership, is to try to appeal to the higher self in everyone.
Arsalan, clearly I'm not asking you to speak for these people, but the insurgents who are currently operating in Iraq and Syria, their stated intention is to create kind of an Islamic led a caliphate, I mean, in the entire region, and they're calling upon Muslims to swear allegiance to them. Recognizing once again, you don't speak for them, but how do they reconcile that with the call during this period of to lay down arms, to be peaceful, and to abstain from kind of the needs of the world, at least sort of during daylight hours? How do they square something like that?
I don't know, because they're maniacs. And, you know, when you're dealing with people who are, you know, operating outside the fold of logic and reason, you know, if anything, I think, you know, if they continue any sort of armed conflict, especially in Iraq with ISIS, you know, during the month of Ramadan, I think that they're going to lose a lot of credibility from people who might have decided to support them. And so I think that that's something that's very important to keep in mind also, is the fact that, you know, this is not just something where you're dealing with state actors and civilians. In many cases, you're dealing with non-state actors against other fellow non-state actors. And again, here, if you're going to claim to have some sort of Islamic or Muslim platform to your political ideology, it would behoove you to, you know, follow the teachings of Islam, not kill innocent civilians anywhere at any time, and, you know, especially during the month of Ramadan.
And Asra, to that end, both of you, you and Arsalan, are both, you know, activists as well as kind of writers and thinkers. I wanted to ask, is there any opportunity for activism here in support of more peaceful solutions in these areas, or peaceful kind of negotiations or end to conflict in these areas? Is there any evidence of that? Did you ever see that when you were working in Pakistan, that this does offer an opportunity for reflection on the part of people to claim the peaceful to advance peaceful causes?
Right. I think that, you know, the sad truth is that while there is a lot of activism and calls for peaceful solutions within our community, I don't believe that we have significant leadership that does provide, you know, the kind of inspiration for a resolution to the struggle within Islam for the peaceful alternative to prevail. You know, I disagree in that I think that the folks that are, you know, this Iraq state that's, you know, being called ISIS or whatever, you know, iteration they're going to have, they have a rationale. They have an Islamic ideology that they are behind. And ultimately, it is up to us to try to challenge that Islamic interpretation that they put forward. They think that they're doing the right thing. They do have a rationale to their approach. And we, I'm afraid, don't have enough of a concerted response to it. I think among leaders, among community members, there's folks that are doing a lot of work, including Arsalan. But at the end of the day, you know, we still haven't won that battle.
Arsalan, a final thought from you. We only have about 40 seconds.
So. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, you know, being here at the Aspen Ideas Festival and people learning that it's Ramadan. They feel really bad that all this, you know, great food, you know, we Muslims aren't allowed to eat. What's really interesting for me very quickly is the fact that here, at least in the United States, there's been a lot of interfaith outreach where you have people from the Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu traditions who will fast in solidarity with their Muslim brothers and sisters here. And similarly, you know, Muslims like myself will go to Passover Seders and, you know, do other and share in other religious events also. And I think that's the sort of interfaith humanization that we need to see here in the United States, and hopefully that'll translate itself abroad as well.
That was Arsalan Iftikhar. He's founder of themuslimguide.com. He's an adjunct professor at DePaul University with us, as he mentioned, from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Here in Washington, D.C., journalist and author Asra Nomani. Her book is called Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Thank you to you both. Ramadan Mubarak to you both.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just ahead, you probably know that inventions made for space travel often end up being very important in our day-to-day lives back here on Earth. Now, NASA has a new program to speed up that process. An executive of the Transfer Technology Program is going to tell us how you can help and maybe even do well for yourself by doing some good for NASA. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
...2014 marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of mostly white student volunteers from colleges across the country spent weeks registering African Americans to vote in Mississippi. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stanley Nelson, the director of a new documentary about Freedom Summer, and Charles Cobb, who helped organize the event. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to experience sustainable specials and everyday indulgences at Intermezzo Cafe. More information about upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to turn now to a new initiative from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. NASA wants to know how their technologies can best be applied commercially, and they are asking you for ideas. Daniel Lockney is here to tell us more about this. He's NASA's Technology Transfer Program Executive, and he was nice enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if people remember how much NASA technology we actually use as consumers. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. The camera in your cell phone was developed by our researchers at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Caltech. Infant formula, 95% of the baby food sold in the world, has an additive that we discovered, the omega-3, omega-6 combination, believed to be important in the development of the brain and the eyes. fatty tissues. We're the first to synthesize it, long-duration spaceflight experiments.
And you were telling me that the shape of the modern truck or the modern semi is a result of some NASA aerodynamics. You were telling me that. But you're also telling me that I was wrong about Tang. NASA actually doesn't get credit for Tang or Velcro.
Yeah, or Teflon.
Or Teflon.
All of these things were popularized by the space program, but invented elsewhere. And we're not opposed to getting ideas from elsewhere.
Well, that's the idea here. So now you're teaming up with a company called Edison Nation. What kinds of things are you looking for?
So this is one of our open innovation projects where we're crowdsourcing. We develop something, perhaps it's a sensor, an optics configuration, or new metal. In this instance, with Edison Nation, it's actually a device that monitors brainwaves and provides feedback to a machine. So we develop technologies, and we know what we're going to use them for, but we often don't know how else they can be used. So we're asking the public through this Edison Nation work and then also through a company called Marblar. And the idea is to tap into the untapped cognitive surplus that people are online, you know, drawing pictures, captioning cat photographs, and doing all of these otherwise creative things. Perhaps we can get them to work for us, too.
What exactly are you asking of people? What are you asking them to do?
So it's almost like we've given them a blank sheet of paper. And we said, what can you make of this? And they would say, I can make an airplane. I can make a hat. I can make a boat. But instead of a blank sheet of paper, we're actually handing them a technology. We're saying, here's a device that has the following characteristics. What else can be done with it? Here's a foam that will get to a specific temperature. We'll rigidize at a specific rate, and we'll get this hard and is this lightweight. What can you use it for?
So I think a lot of people are familiar now with crowdsourcing, I mean, like Kickstarter, or for that matter, an NPR fundraising campaign, right?
Right.
And so you're looking to the public to fund something that they like. In this instance, the thing already exists, so you're looking for, what, ideas?
That's right.
Yeah,
we're not asking for dollars. We're asking for clever ideas. And then the options spiral out from there. If someone who proposes an idea is interested in actually pursuing it for commercialization, they're more than welcome to, and we'll work with them to do that. If they have an idea but the technology needs further R&D, further development, we can help with that. If they just want to give the idea and say, hey, somebody should do this, then we can also pursue that as well.
So this sounds so crass, but what's in it for me? If I participate in this, what's in it for me? I understand that there is an answer to that question. There is something other than the pleasure of seeing your ideas come to life, that there's actually potentially royalties involved, right?
Perhaps. So there's a way that this could be structured. There's so many different possibilities with it. First, if you just propose an idea, you get the same gratification as if, you know, you captioned one of those funny cat photos and a bunch of people liked it. You get a bunch of thumbs up on the internet for it. So that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you could license the technology, create your own company around it, and go off, and you would actually receive dollars from sales. The royalty income is slightly different. That's dollars that come back to the government, and we are the most generous agency in terms of what we give the inventors. So a large chunk, most of what first comes in from a licensing arrangement, goes to the actual government inventor. The rest goes toward kind of routine patent maintenance fees and such.
But you're saying that there is the opportunity for the sharing of commercial benefit.
Absolutely.
As a consequence of this. This is not, I mean, getting a like is nice, but you're talking about possibilities for kind of commercial remuneration as a consequence of participation in this, which is logical, right?
Absolutely. We did a survey very recently. It went back over 10 years of companies that had taken our technologies and commercialized them and found some pretty impressive results. Several, you know, tens of billions of dollars in increased revenue from companies that use our technology. Several hundred thousand lives saved as a result of incorporation of our technologies into consumer products. Jobs created, tens of thousands.
Well, before we let you go, I wanted to ask about a couple of things that I think people do know that NASA does, which is still space exploration. That I wanted to ask you about NASA's Orion test flight scheduled for later this year. I understand that there's a new computer system involved. It's 25 times faster than the International Space Station computers and 4,000 times faster than its predecessors in the Apollo program. Tell me about that. I mean, is there any chance that this technology will make it into consumer products? And of course, you know, I have to ask you about the flying saucer. I'm going to ask you to tell me about that.
Sure, absolutely. So computers and software are an increasingly large portion of the technical work that we do. There's still a lot of hardware. There's still a lot of traditional R&D, but we're finding software is increasingly important. As a matter of fact, just this year, we released for the first time a complete NASA software catalog that we talked about getting some of these ideas out to the public with over 1,000 codes, all free for secondary application. And these are business tools, design software, a whole line of everything we've ever done work in is now available for the public.
And tell me about the flying saucer, and I'm using that term colloquially, of course, but NASA launched an experimental, I think, vehicle this weekend. Tell us about it over Hawaii. So I guess what a lot of people are saying is if you thought you saw a flying saucer over Hawaii Saturday, you weren't crazy. So tell us what it was.
It's the LDST, the low-density supersonic decelerator. And the idea behind it is you produce enough drag for re-entry into the atmosphere. In this instance, we're talking about the Martian atmosphere, that you need to slow down the spacecraft before you can gently land it onto the surface. You don't want to go careening into the surface of Mars after spending all that time to get there. Typically, we've been using the technology, the parachute technology that we developed during the Viking lander era. And it's the same thing that we used to get Curiosity to slow down in 2012 for that landing. And the idea is that we would have larger, heavier spacecraft that need newer technologies, more advanced technologies to help slow them down. So instead of a parachute, it's kind of a long, almost like a blob, the flying saucer that will slow down the spacecraft before it reaches the atmosphere.
And what will this allow? Why is this important?
We'll have larger, heavier spacecraft for Mars, and the typical parachutes that we've been using in the past won't be able to sustain that landing.
So it's an important milestone.
The idea is to land humans on Mars in the next couple of decades, and this is an important next step.
Daniel Lochne is NASA's Technology Transfer Program Executive. He was nice enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Daniel Lochne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
We'd like to take a moment now to talk about an issue we've visited a few times on this program, diversity in the media. Diane Sawyer recently announced that she's stepping down as anchor of ABC World News.
You may have heard some exciting news from right here at home at ABC. At the end of the summer, I'm going to be moving to a new role at the network, full-time, flat out, of reporting I love from around the world and in-depth specials on the stories that matter so much to all our lives.
The change at ABC means that David Muir, who currently hosts ABC World News Weekend, will step in as anchor during the week, and Good Morning America co-host George Stephanopoulos will take on a new role as the face of the network, for example, steering election night coverage. And while these kinds of changes happen periodically in a business that places a lot of physical and personal demands on people, it's also reviving the debate about the importance of diversity in television, especially television news, because after Sawyer's departure, all the broadcast network nightly news programs will be led, once again, by white males. So we're going to talk about this with Eric Dagans. He's NPR's television critic, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington, D.C. Eric, it's nice to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
So before we talk about the news programs, I want to talk about something else that has recently happened. Some recent developments on ABC's daytime program, The View. Longtime host Sherry Shepherd announced that she will leave the program after serving as a co-host for 7 years. And then after that, another host, Jenny McCarthy, the actress, announced that she'll be leaving. She even tweeted about it, saying, if Sherry goes, then I go too. And I just wanted to ask, what do you think this all means?
Well, it's interesting to see that all of these changes, including the rumored departure of Bill Getty, the longtime executive producer of the show, right after Barbara Walters leaves. I think if you read the tea leaves as long as I have in television, once Barbara was gone, it seems as if ABC is making the kind of changes they wanted to make. And I think there was a sense that they wanted to blow up the panel, make it more interesting. Jenny McCarthy's always had a hard time fitting in there. And now that Barbara's gone, perhaps ABC has a freer hand to remake the show the way they want to.
Back to the Diane Sawyer announcement. The question that I have to ask is, what does it mean that there were, a couple of years ago, both Katie Couric and Diane Sawyer were anchoring evening news programs, and now it's back to where it was?
Where it was before. I think a couple of things are going on. Number one, we have seen the importance of the evening news diminished. The sense that they have taken all the big marquee things that the evening news anchor used to do, like leading election coverage and breaking news coverage, and given them to George Stephanopoulos, who's the morning anchor, I think that's significant. David Muir will have a lesser role than somebody like Peter Jennings because it will be much harder for him to be the face of the network. Also, though, what we've seen is this lack lack of a pipeline for female journalists. Who could come in and anchor a network evening newscast at ABC? What woman is positioned to contest with David Muir for that job? Where's the pipeline for female talent? Where's the pipeline for people of color in the network news game? And let's create one if there isn't.
Well, why is that, though?
I think it's a specific choice. For example, I just came out of newspapers. In the newspaper where I used to work, the Tampa Bay Times, women are in key leadership roles throughout the organization now. It's something that's happened over the last 20 years. Are we seeing this kind of pipeline built in the network news game? Who's the executive producers of these shows? Are women being able to ascend to those jobs? And when you have people in a job who can picture a woman anchoring, then maybe they'll allow them to anchor. I just can't believe that in 2014, there's not enough female talent out there to fill the ranks of these network news anchoring jobs. And the fact that there isn't tells me that there's something else going on beyond the numbers game or chance, or they just can't find the right people. They're not trying to find the right people.
But you also said that the George Stephanopoulos being named chief anchor, and he is the anchor of the morning show as well as the Sunday morning public affairs program.
Sure.
What does that suggest? That they consider really morning to be driving?
Morning is the coverage. Most important day part for network news because it makes the most money.
Generally, but the numbers aren't the biggest, though. That still has to be said. The network evening news programs still have bigger numbers.
They have bigger total audiences, but when you look at the core demographic that they charge advertising for example, Good Morning America draws a little more people aged 25 to 54 than the evening news does. So aggregate audiences, evening news does better. But in terms of the money-making potential, and it's not just that it's demographically they have more numbers, advertisers want to be in that show more. You know, they feel like they're reaching their ideal consumer. They're reaching women who are making the purchasing decisions for their households often. And so I think it's not just that it's more of that demographic, it's a more desirable type of that demographic as well.
But what's the diversity picture there? I mean, women are famous for being morning news anchors and having a big impact as morning news anchors.
Exactly. And so that's the one bright spot, is that if the power position in network news shifts to the morning, then the women have a better chance of getting in on that action, because there are women in the morning shows who are more than qualified to be the face of a network news division if they're developed. Savannah Guthrie on NBC's Today Show has a hard news background. Certainly, if she wanted that job, she could contend for it. So that's the one bright spot, is that by shifting the center of power to the morning, at least women will have a shot to play in that game a little more than maybe they do now.
We're talking about diversity in television with NPR's television critic Eric Dagan. So let's talk a little bit about Elsewhere on the Dial, not a news program, but one that's generating a lot of interest in some fairly heated response. It's a program
sure.
called Tyrant, which premiered last week on the cable network FX. It's a show about a California doctor who is the son of a dictator of a fictional Middle Eastern country. And I have a short clip from the first episode where the son, Bassam, sees his father for the first time in about 20 years. And in this clip, the father, the dictator, talks about protests in the country.
After everything I've given the people, you're still not satisfied. They say they want freedom. Freedom. To do what? Kill each other?
This is a show that's getting a lot of attention because a number of advocacy groups that represent people of Muslim or Middle Eastern background say they are outraged about this. They think it's racist. I do want to mention that there is one group, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, that says that they were involved with the production. But Eric, what about it?
There's a sense when you watch the show that the more Americanized characters are considered the more virtuous characters. And the problem is that many of the characters who are Arab or Muslim on the show are bloodthirsty. The first time you encounter an Arab character, you see the brother of the lead character, you know, raping a woman. I think they really have a point. It could have been so great. It could have been a very nuanced depiction of what do you do when you have a tyrant who's bloodthirsty, but maybe he's holding together a country where everybody else is bloodthirsty too, and everybody's got, you know, blood on their hands, and how do you deal with this? But instead, you have this Americanized son who left the country, and then he comes back and he has all these ideas about free speech and a new way of doing things, and he's presented as the virtuous guy who will stop his bloodthirsty relatives from pillaging the country that they've run for 20 years. And I would not blame an advocacy group for looking at that and saying that's just not a fair depiction of Arab life or of Muslim life.
Is there any response from FX about this?
They did set up a screening for some representatives of these advocacy groups, and I interviewed a representative of one of them who said he walked out of the screening when he saw the second rape scene involving this brother in the pilot. I mean, you know, the guy assaults a woman not once, but twice. There's also a scene where that same character cuts off someone's finger. So I think the only hope is that as they move forward, or even if somebody else decides to do something like this, the idea is promising, but you have to be careful to not create these stereotypes. And unfortunately, they have created a show that is just filled with them instead of taking the opportunity to subvert them. And when you subvert stereotypes on a TV show, that's when it's interesting, because you don't know what to expect. You can't look at a character and predict how they're going to act. And that's why I don't understand why more TV shows don't do that anyway.
Eric Dagans is NPR's television critic. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, Belgian pop sensation Stromae wrote his country's World Cup anthem, but he also writes danceable tunes about touchy topics like fatherhood and masculinity.
The question is, what's a good father? What's a father? What's a bad father? And actually, the answer is we're just trying to do our best.
We'll have an encore of our conversation with international pop star Stromae. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at Hewlett.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Well, this is it, the final day in WILL's fiscal year. After 364 days, our amazing friends have put us in great shape to reach our goal of more than $2.2 million. But we're not quite there yet. So if you've been putting off making an additional gift, renewing your membership, or joining for the first time, call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org. And to be sure your gift counts toward this fiscal year, please pay by credit card.
I'm Robin Young. A new breed of television has arrived, and it boasts four times the definition of the best HD TV. But is your cable company ready?
It's a real issue to try and get all that extra picture detail out to the TV where you can actually watch it.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
On the next POV on WILL-TV, Grace Lee Boggs is a 98-year-old Chinese-American philosopher, writer, and activist with a surprising vision of what an American revolution can be. Rooted in 75 years of the labor, civil rights, and black power movements, she challenges a new generation to throw off old assumptions and redefine revolution for our times. Watch American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs, tonight at 9 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we'll hear about one actor's curious road to the top. It's part of a series by our colleagues at All Things Considered called My Big Break. That's where people talk about critical turning points in their careers. Michael Kenneth Williams has won acclaim playing a series of ruthless but complicated gangsters. But if you saw him as Omar Little on The Wire and the equally terrifying Chalky White on Boardwalk Empire, you might be surprised to know that before all that, he was a dancer in music videos. He performed with artists like Madonna and George Michael. Here's Michael K. Williams talking about his big break.
I was doing a bunch of videos, just dancing background. But then on my birthday, on my 25th birthday, I got cut in my face in a ballroom brawl. There was a popping party going on in Queens. Went outside to get some air, and I saw that two of my other friends was being surrounded by some dudes who I didn't know. And it looked like they were about to get jumped. And I said, yo, I'm ready to leave. Let's go back. I'm going to go back home now. But this one dude kept pacing behind me. He kept walking behind me. He kept like, psst, like, you know, like sucking his teeth. And I'm looking, I'm like, yo, what's up, dude? I'm like, yo, bro, what's your problem? And the dude wiped his hand across his mouth and just... what I thought it appeared to be smacked me. But what he did was he spit a razor. He was positioning the razor in his mouth to get it between his middle finger and his ring finger. And then he just went wiped me down my face. And this cut in my face was actually the first hit of the fight. So we managed to escape with our lives barely that night. Things changed immediately after that. Directors didn't want me just to dance in the videos anymore. They wanted me to act out these thug roles. You know, I was like, you know, Mike, roll these dice in this video. Have this fight in this video. I was like, all right. Tupac Shakur was filming a movie in New York called Bullet, opposite Mickey Rourke. And the production office that they were working out of in New York happened to have a Polaroid picture of me from me going to audition from some various music video. So he happened to see a Polaroid picture of me and was like, yo, this dude looks thugged out enough that he could play my little brother. I think he saw my pain, my struggle, my heart. I was just like, I was starstruck, you know? I was like, wow, it's Tupac Shakur.
And if you was half as smart as I thought you was, Patty boy, you'd be minding your business right now.
I tell you, we know all about your little hotshot package.
Tupac was larger than life. I spent a lot of time just listening to him and watching him because I learned so much. He's that kind of person. It's like a walking encyclopedia. I shot that movie, still dancing, and I had booked a major supporting role on Law & Order. I had booked a major supporting role on Sopranos. So, you know, I got a little high on the horse. You know, yeah, I ain't going to L.A. L.A. going to send for me. You know what I mean? So I'm like, my phone will be ringing any minute now. And it didn't happen. And I got really financially strapped. My mom opened up a daycare in the projects where we lived. So in 2000, she was like, why don't you come work in the daycare? You know, I'm paying your rent anyway. You might as well earn it. So I said, Ma, you know, I want to give this acting thing one more shot. It doesn't work. I'm done. It's me and you. We changing Pampers, baby. My phone did not ring. And man, I was down in the dumps. I got really depressed. Like, really depressed. And then March came. And one day she called me and said, you got a fax downstairs here. I went downstairs to her office. And it was the breakdown for Omar from The Wire on HBO.
State your name for the record.
Omar Devone Little.
And what is your occupation?
I rip and run.
You?
I robs drug dealers.
Mr. Little, how does a man rob drug dealers for 8 or 9 years and live to tell about it?
Date of time, I suppose.
I got to grow with an amazing group of people that I consider my Wire family. That character changed my life. And that was my big break.
That was actor Michael Kenneth Williams. To hear more stories about other people's big breaks, just visit npr.org. Finally, today we're ending on a musical note. You might remember my conversation earlier this year with recording artist Stromae. He's already one of the biggest names in dance music in Europe. You're going to be hearing more about him because he's heading out on his first major North American tour later this year. Before then, though, soccer fans take note, he wrote Belgium's World Cup anthem, Tafet, and you might catch it when the Belgians play Team USA tomorrow. To let you know a bit more about him, Stromae, whose birth name is Paul Van Haver, was born and raised in his mother's native Belgium, speaking French. His father was from Rwanda. He didn't see much of him growing up. When I caught up with him earlier this year when he was on a brief visit to the U.S., I was curious about how he got interested in music, and I learned that he was not a particularly enthusiastic student, but his mother insisted he choose an instrument. He chose the drums. But when he stopped by, I asked him where the inspiration for his musical voice came from.
Actually, I'm just like a photographer or like a director. Of course, I have an opinion, but I don't think my opinion or what I want to say or what I want to give is so obvious, because that's not my job. My job is just to give a point of view, not more than that.
You're like reporting,
That's
you know how they used to say that rap is the CNN of the streets? You remember? Did you hear that?
No, but that's true. That's so true, yeah.
Yeah. So that's how you feel? Like you feel like you're reporting?
Yes, but not about a situation. It's about something that nobody cares about. Hmm. For example, for Formidable, this guy that I saw 10 years ago, which was a homeless, he was just asking to my girlfriend and me a coins or something to eat. Hmm. And actually, he was a little bit aggressive. And the problem is that this guy decided to say to us, "Do you think you are beautiful?" to my girlfriend and me, really aggressively. Mm. And I wasn't really angry. I was just wondering why this guy decided to say it to me at this moment. And later, like 10 years later, I created the song Formidable, which is like a mix between this guy, a friend of mine, which was a little bit drunk. And the track is not talking about drunk or drugs or stuff like, or marginal, or you know, somebody aggressive, or just sadness and loneliness. That's the meaning of my song, actually.
Yeah, let's play a little bit for people who have not heard it. This is Formidable, and I want to talk about the video, but let's play a little bit of it. Here it is.
Oh, tu t'es regardé, tu te crois beau parce que tu t'es marié, mais c'est qu'un anneau, mec, t'emballe pas. Elle va te larguer comme elles le font chaque fois. Et puis l'autre fille, tu lui en as parlé. Si tu veux, je lui dis, comme ça c'est réglé. Et au petit aussi, enfin si vous en avez. Attends 3 ans, 7 ans et là vous verrez si c'est formidable. Formidable. Tu étais formidable, j'étais formidable. Nous étions formidables.
It seems like a fellow after a bad breakup, and you know, he's kind of reeling after a bad breakup. And there is that line that you mentioned from the encounter you had where it says, "Hey, take a look at yourself. Think you're Mr. Handsome just because you got married? This is but a ring, man. Don't get carried away. She'll dump you like they always do. Now about the other girl, did you tell her?" So it goes on. It seems kind of a little intense. But the video is you kind of stumbling around on the street in Brussels, and you seem like you're drunk, and the cameras are, I think they're hidden, they seem hidden, are filming the encounters that various people have with you, and some people seem to know you, like they're taking your picture, and
yes,
some
is.
People try to help you, and the police
exactly.
come at one point, and they seem kind of nice. Was this all a put-on? You were pretending to be drunk, right? Just to see people's reactions, correct?
Exactly.
So how did that idea come about? It was very interesting.
This kind of video, like real videos in the street, are maybe more interesting for people than when I'm trying to work on, you know, real creative works. And I was a little bit sad to know that. But actually, we are like that. I'm like that, too. I'm a human. So I decided to
So the idea of sort
like,
of catching a star, a celebrity like yourself, drunk and in the street, was kind of more entertaining for people, even though you weren't drunk, just to clarify, was more entertaining than actually watching you film like a performed piece.
Mm-hmm.
How do people feel now that they know that it was really a performance? It was a performance. So are
actually,
they okay with it?
I think that people were surprised. The only message is only that this video clip is a mirror of us. That's all.
Pourquoi t'es tout rouge? Reviens, gamin. Et qu'est-ce que vous avez tous à me regarder comme un singe, vous? Ah oui, vous êtes sains, vous. Bande de macaques, donnez-moi un bébé singe. Il sera formidable.
We wanted to do this video and we didn't know what we could expect. And it was a big surprise to see that, yeah, we had like a policeman. We had three people who were like filming at me. Somebody who was laughing about me, somebody who was trying to help me, somebody who was just ignoring me. And I think that's what we are.
Formidable. Tu étais formidable, j'étais formidable. Nous étions formidables.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Stromae. He's become one of the biggest names in dance music in Europe, and we were actually able to catch up with him on a visit to the U.S. There's another song that I really want to talk with you about, and it's Papa Ute.
Yes, it is.
And I just want to play a little bit, and then I'll ask you to translate a little bit. Here it is.
Des géniteurs ou des génies, dites-nous qui donne naissance aux irresponsables, hein? Dites-nous qui. Tiens, tout le monde sait comment on fait des bébés, mais personne sait comment on fait des papas. Monsieur, je sais tout, on aurait hérité, c'est ça, faut le sucer de son pouce ou quoi. Dites-nous où c'est caché, ça doit faire au moins mille fois qu'on a bouffé nos doigts. Hey, où t'es, papa, où t'es?
And, it, you know, the video is devastating, if you don't mind my saying, as a mother. It is devastating because it's a little boy who's trying to get his father to react and who's the father is kind of like a mannequin. So he's there but not there. Mm-hmm. And the boy is going through all this, trying to get him to play soccer and kind of engage with him. And he can't, of course, because he's a mannequin. Mm-hmm. The lyrics, do you want to translate a bit for us from what we just heard?
I'm just trying to ask what's our father job. And that's the question, and I don't have the answer, actually. Of course, my personal life is that I didn't really know my father. I met him, like, sometimes, and he died in the Rwandese genocide. So that's why I was educated by my mother only. And, of course, it's a question that I have, but it's not because I didn't grow up with my father that I have this kind of question. It's just because I'm a man. The question is, what's a good father? What's a father? What's a bad father? And actually the answer is we just trying to do our best.
Yeah, the chorus is, where are you? Papa, where are you?
Yeah,
and one of the lyrics that I think really struck me is that, you know, come on, tell us, who does? Everyone knows how babies are made, but no one knows how fathers are made, Mr. Know-it-all. It's in our blood, that's it. And it's like I say, it's. How does your mother feel about it, if you don't mind my asking?
Actually, she was touched by the song, of course, because I'm his son. But she loved the song, yeah, she loved the song. She's a fan. I think she's my first fan.
Well, she's your mother, of course. you play the mannequin, just for people who haven't seen it yet.
Yes,
you play the mannequin, and quite a handsome one, if you don't mind my saying.
This kind of image of the father is beautiful because that's what we want of a father, and that's what we don't want of a father. It's so paradoxal, of course, but I think we are paradoxal when we are children or teenagers. And actually, that's the question that we ask always, all the time, to our father.
Did you ever ask him? Did you ever, before you mentioned that, you know, your father was killed in the Rwandan genocide? Mm. Did you ever have the opportunity to ask him why he wasn't more present in your life?
Maybe I asked the question, but I don't remember. Mm. He died when I was 9, so I don't have any precision. In my souvenir. Mm. I'm sorry for my English.
No, it's fine. I understand what you're saying.
You know, actually, when I was a teenager, I was maybe a little bit angry. And until before I created the song, I was still a little bit angry, but I decided to have less angry about my father and just decided to say, okay, I'm already 28 and I think I have to grow up because he's not there anymore. Hmm. And I think that I'm here and I have to do my best for the next one. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Well, what is next for you? Are you hoping to record in English? Are you hoping to, you know, cross the pond and do something in the U.S.?
I think I can come in the U.S. even if I speak French. I hope. That's my big hope, actually. So, yeah, just continue to sing in French and to be listened by non-French people.
So is that the goal then? You want to sing in French and let in French and let people figure it out? Is that the plan? Just deal with it, right?
I think it's about a feeling more than a language. Hmm. And I think that we and every culture in the world has to keep their own language just to bring something else, something different, and show a different vision of the world, actually. Hmm. And that's why I'm trying to keep my language.
And what about being a man of color? Has that played a role in your career?
What does that mean exactly, a man of
color? Man of color?
Yeah.
I mean, interestingly, in this country, we use that to mean mm-hmm. people who are not white, basically. That's pretty much it, not white.
Okay, color.
That's
okay,
kind of
okay.
How we use it.
The thing is, I'm not brown or white. That's the thing. I'm just half and half. My father is black, was black. My mother is white. And... Mm-hmm. I don't think it's about the color or something. It's just about feelings. And the thing is, everybody live exactly the same things. We are all humans, even if you speak Spanish or whatever you speak. That's just, we are humans, and that's really interesting. And I'm sure that we can understand each other, even if you don't understand my language.
Paul Van Haver, known as Stromae, is a Belgian singer, songwriter, dancer, and he was kind enough to join us in our studios at NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Stromae, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for vos invitations, pardon.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.